Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is presented by Forever Cheese. Learn more at forevercheese.com.
I'm Allison Kane, and welcome to In the Sauce, a podcast about building consumer brands from the ground up. I love doing this show because I get to interview everyone from production gurus to marketing and social media mavens, anyone who can guide me on this crazy journey. This is the story of building Haven's Kitchen sauces, but it's also the story of every growing brand because we're all in the sauce.
Today, I'm speaking with Anthony Domenici, co-founder of Basecamp Consulting Group, the fractional CFO and bookkeeping team for CPG companies looking to scale sustainably. Anthony is a finance and accounting expert with a career spanning nearly 20 years and has worked with public and private companies ranging in revenue from $1 million to $5 billion. Basecamp offers a full-service suite of financial services with a team comprised of entrepreneurs, operators, and advocates. Welcome, Anthony.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Super excited to join you today.
Yeah, so I just finished episode 202, and I was sort of looking back and, you know, reminiscing a bit and thinking a little bit how my episodes probably similar to sort of like the way that people have thinking about CPG in the last couple of years have shifted somewhat from a majority of discussions about growth and marketing and sales to, I feel like my latest episodes have been much heavier on financial health, operations, you know, the not as fun, shiny stuff. And I guess I'm wondering, you know, you've been in this, you've been here for 20 years. Are you A, very much the same noticing that shift, and B, does it feel like you're having more conversations about like, help me get profitable now more than ever? Or does this feel like just cyclical to you because you've seen this before?
Well, I would say short answer is yes, but you know, this, it can be both. It is sort of cyclical and, you know, I guess more financial urgency maybe. You know, I think that there is a period of time in maybe every economic expansion where capital is sort of free flowing and, you know, you want to catch the upswing and there's sort of high confidence in your ability to raise money. Debt and equity are easier to come by. There's more competition for investments, which push valuations higher. And I think over the last, you know, especially year, probably 18 months, those started to slow down. So I think the access to capital has really driven kind of the sense of urgency I'm talking about. And it may not even be let's get profitable for everyone, but it's more about how do I make my cash last longer? I think if you're just less confident that you have access to capital or equity or debt or whatever it is, you're more thoughtful about how you're spending. So you might be reducing expenses when in a direction of getting profitable. But it's really more about cash, I think, when it comes down to it. And of course, if you are profitable, you have surplus cash.
Right. No, that makes sense. And it's funny because I had Greg Wank on a couple weeks ago from Anshin, and he was saying that this all sort of started before COVID, but then COVID happened and sort of created all of these very strange patterns. One of them being just like a massive, you know, just greater desire for consumer goods and cooking at home and products that, all of that. And now we're sort of seeing a little bit, A, what would have happened had COVID not happened, but also the tailwinds of COVID, which have now also impacted supply chain and retailers. You know, it's kind of this double whammy a little bit. Is that how you would sort of paint the picture as well?
Yeah, I think it's COVID created an interesting dynamic just because of this sort of like bullwhip in some cases where, you know, your business got massively disrupted and then it was on fire. And then now like some of the distribution channels are stuffed. So you have working capital issues. Not you might have, you know, too much inventory in distributors and surplus inventory where you wanted to make sure you didn't run out and you bought too much. And there's kind of a big impact of that where I think, you know, in addition, just debt didn't really matter for a little while. That was so cheap. And now it's starting to matter. So I don't know. I think there's a combination of dynamics there that certainly have affected CPG. And there's sort of this pendulum swing too of, you know, hyper intensive direct consumer activity. You know, the change with, you know, iOS and all these other things and just the return on those ad spends reducing, it might be swinging back more towards the retail side. Right. And, you know, the cash flow dynamics of that are also a lot different. So I think there's a number of things happening that I think making cash flow in your business more difficult. And it's sort of like I've heard it talked about like the non-recession recession where if you're holding assets, you know, increasing the cost of debt and interest rates make those assets more expensive. Where sales may not necessarily have dropped for, you know, a lot of brands, but just kind of running your business day to day, the, making sure your cash flow cycle is working properly for you and just kind of managing your business has become a lot more difficult, I think.
Yeah. I know we didn't necessarily draft this or talk about it when we were talking about the episode, but is that essentially what happened with Instant Pot? You know, like they went bankrupt. It's like people are really confusing. So do you know about this? Like,
I'm not familiar with that story yet.
So Instant Pot is like, you know, it's like the slow cooker that became synonymous with slow cooking. You know, there is a brand.
It's like a pressure cooker.
Yeah. And I think they own Pyrex. They own a couple of brands. Anyway, they just filed for Chapter 11. They have gazillions in sales. I mean, I guess part of, you know, we don't need to dig into it since it's the first year hearing of it. But I think what's always kind of shocking for a founder is that you can be doing really well and you can have excellent sales and you can still end up losing your business.
100%.
Yeah. And that really comes from managing the cash, essentially.
Yeah, I think it kind of goes back. I think there's going to be sort of like a common thread here that we end up talking about, which is cash flow. And it really has been a staple of the Basecamp business. I mean, kind of a lot of what we built this on beginning was having to do with cash, helping businesses cash flow during the pandemic, the first year of the pandemic. But yeah, I mean, if you're looking at growth as must grow at all costs and you're not profitable, you might have tens of millions of dollars in revenue and be negative net income, millions of dollars. One day that's going to matter. And if you can't pivot quick enough and you're not watching your balance sheet, which, you know, might be a little too deep for this call being, you know, sort of like a finance nerd, but, you know, if your liabilities are far exceeding your ability to generate cash quick enough, that's kind of usually what ends up happening with bankruptcy is just not able to meet your commitments. And, you know, there's covenants and all kinds of things that you can get into of who can take control of your company, but that's the quickest way to kind of lose your company. Either you might be private equity backed or your capital partners will end up taking over the business and kicking you out, or the bank takes over. I mean, there's a bunch of different scenarios, but yeah, just sort of getting overextended. And I think if you're growing quickly, while it can be very exciting, that's one of the risks, is just sort of getting overextended at the wrong time. And it also can come down to a little bit of luck or bad luck. I mean,
right. No, I mean, it's funny because, you know, I mean, I ran a brick and mortar for 8 years, and it was very, you know, I mean, people have listened to the podcast, have heard me say this. I remember when we decided to switch from paper towels to an electric, like, Dyson hand blower. And mm-hmm. we waited until after we had, you know, two weddings to go get the the hand blower. Like, every decision we made was based on literally what we had in the bank. And
yeah,
then when I got into CPG, it seemed like all the signals around me were telling me that stuff didn't matter as much, which is, you know, partially my fault for just not really understanding. But I think very few founders actually really understand, you know, we're told a few things. One is, you know, product margins somewhere above 60%, gross margin somewhere above 40%, you know, G&A, you shouldn't hire too many people at too high salaries until whatever. But, like, we don't really totally understand cash flow and balance sheet and, like, liabilities and those covenants. We're not, I don't think, expected to entirely, but a lot of, like, early stage companies, we can't afford the time and the resources of, you know, the real finance folks. And the finance folks that a lot of people in the early stages do interact with, on one hand, are, you know, bookkeepers who are just making sure that you are paying the bills and getting paid. And on the other hand, you know, sometimes VCs, who their models have nothing to do with actual day-to-day running of a business. They're just these, like, you're going to double, and then you're going to double, and then you're going to double, you know, so, like, we're kind of missing, I guess that's where, you know, folks like you come in. But I mean, do you see it a lot? Yeah. Do you see people just being like, what, you know, what are these things and why are they relevant? And what do I need to learn and know, like, the back of my hand to be able to run this business thoughtfully?
Yeah. So I think there's a couple things that I wanted to touch on there that you mentioned. One is, you know, starting with bookkeepers, we always recommend starting with bookkeeping early. You have to have clean books to be able to make good decisions about your business. And having a CPG kind of focused bookkeeper who understands how things are supposed to work is really important. And I think the other thing that we often see, let's just assume your books are right, but having somebody that is willing to kind of partner with you with your business and add a little bit more value to the numbers, which is kind of our manifesto. That's really what we're trying to do here, is be true business partners, add value to, you know, somebody that says, oh, here's your books and good luck with that. But what we're trying to do is give you a little more insight. We have a team of entrepreneurs and sort of business owners, and we've been on the other side of the table with, like, you know, the founder's mentality. We call it the founder's mindset. So having been on that side of the table and, you know, growing our own business too, just, you know, growing Basecamp, I think we try to bring that added value, because you're right. I don't think you're expected to know all of that, all of those things. And one of the things we do see as well is if we take over books, you know, I think initially a lot of founders may have, you know, someone they know doing their bookkeeping, or sort of, you know, like their cousin or their uncle or something. And I don't think people pay attention to the balance sheet a lot, and that can sort of get you in trouble.
Right. We're looking at the P&L much more than the balance sheet.
Yeah. And that's not exactly wrong, but there's, you know, there's a component of that where things can be hidden, right? So, like, if you're creating entries that are incorrect and it's sort of just covered up by shoving them in an account on the balance sheet. So if you're, I guess that's a watch out. So if you have an account on your balance sheet that's just growing for no reason and you don't know what it is, you probably should call somebody and have them look at it. That's a watch out for brands.
Okay, good one.
So, The other thing that I think that you mentioned is just affording, you know, finance people. So there are, you know, that's another value prop that we're basically trying to bring is just, you know, fractional help that is affordable and can give you the experience of somebody that, you know, if you hired full time would be, you know, a world-class CFO could be $300,000-$500,000 a mm-hmm. year, you know, depending on the size of your company. So having access to people that have those expertise and can add a little value and kind of keep you within maybe some guidelines or some guardrails, I think is a lot of, provides a lot of value.
Yeah, no, I mean, what I'd like to do, if you don't mind, is like, just take a theoretical snack company. Let's just take a cookie company. They just launched in global Whole Foods. And as a consequence of that, they now have opened all of the UNFI DCs, and they have, you know, whether it's outsourced or whatever, they're getting retailers, they're opening doors, they're, you know, banging through the UNFI sort of ecosystem. And let's say they're going to be doing about $3 million for the year. That founder is now trying to create a dashboard for herself, you know, with whoever is doing the numbers. What would you say most important things she should be looking at on that dashboard? And is it weekly? Is it monthly? I would imagine it's not quarterly. What are the key indicators that founder needs to know as they sort of enter the big bad world of, you know, distribution and multiple retailers and.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the number one thing that comes to mind is, you know, velocities, understanding the velocities in the doors that you're in will help inform a lot of the decisions that come after that. After unlocking that, I mean, that's a very exciting time, but at the same time, things are getting much more complicated. So having inventory at multiple DCs, you know, multiple POs coming from multiple places, mm-hmm. and obviously the build backs, like the chargebacks, that's a whole animal in itself. So, I mean, as far as, you know, weekly and monthly, I mean, I think you really have to have somebody that understands what you agree to with your distributor and what they're charging you for. Because I think some of those things are going to be mistakes that you've made, mm-hmm. Where you need to learn from that and prevent that. And some of them are going to be mistakes that they've made and you need to hold them accountable to fix it and not charge you too much. So I think understanding the, you know, the amount of expense related to opening a new door is also really important.
So in terms of brass tacks, though, I got a review on Apple Podcasts that I talk too much and interrupt my guests. And I'm very cognizant now that I just interrupted you. But the reason why I'm interrupting is for a good cause, because so we're gonna talk about velocities in a second. But I think we understand that we need to know what UNFI or KeHE or any of them is charging us. We need to have our eye on it, but we don't entirely know what that means or how. So is there a way for us to ask whoever is doing our numbers to say, I need to see this every week or every month or whatever it is, every billing cycle or however, from UNFI, and these are the people that need to have access to this so that we can keep ourselves and them accountable. Like what will show us what that cost is? You know what I mean?
Yeah. So having those, I think a little bit of detail in the billbacks, like the categories that they're coming in, whether they're, you know, related to revenue and, you know, if it's like coupon driven or those types of things, scans, and whether they're more kind of fee-based, the category that they're in, as a percentage of revenue is usually helpful to kind of just gauge. Also, just accruing them in the right period. So you want to be matching up your expenses with the revenue related to that will be helpful. Just to kind of gauge whether it's increasing or decreasing. I think you also just want to make sure, you know, of your best-selling SKUs that you have enough inventory to meet the demand. So sort of understanding the trend of, you know, the demand on those products. And I think the thing that I often see in a scaling company is trying to make sure everything is in stock all the time will cost you a lot of cash.
Right.
So I think, again, it comes back to cash flow. But as you're ramping sales, you're going to have a big draw on cash to have inventory to meet those sales. So I think trying to understand how things are being ordered and your, you know, your product mix and what's the most important will help you kind of manage your cash over that time. But you know, watching your AR and relative to your sales on a monthly basis. So, you know, I think there's this thought that, you know, if you're on net 30, you're going to get paid on time. That's usually not the case. There's going to be, you're going to have to follow up. You're going to have to make sure you're getting paid. The check probably may go to the wrong mailbox. So it's something you have to watch. Because if you have a big order and you miss that check, I mean, it could mean, you know, it could be a disaster for some companies at the wrong time. And then a lot of the KPIs that we always just talk about are, you know, year over year, month over month, measuring against your budget, your inventory turns. So as you're scaling, you know, it all comes back to working capital and cash flow for me, I guess.
Right.
So a lot of those metrics.
And so let's just say, going back to this cookie company, they have four SKUs and they're looking at that Whole Foods portal and, you know, they see really, really strong velocities in two of them and not as strong in the other two. And they're, you know, they, I guess, you know, what does that tell them then? You know, like what we all have, you know, we all have our winner SKUs. It kind of, you know, winner begets winner in the sense that the minute that you start selling to other places, they say, what are your top SKUs? And then essentially you have, you know, a couple of them that are in every account and then a few of them that are spread sort of over a bunch of accounts, which isn't great if, you know, you have, you know, MOQs or volume helps you, you know, in any way. So when you're advising people, you know, all right, look at the velocities. What are you asking them to do once they look at the velocities? Like, what's the takeaway? Okay, we know our velocities. We see them. We see that they're growing. We see that they're, you know, some do better in the Midwest than others. But then what?
Yeah, I think, I mean, you really have to look at your business and what's happening and decide if you're willing to make the tough decisions to cut something or maybe innovate in a way that's closer to the success that you're having. I think there's no one answer for any company, I think, in a lot of these things. And a lot of times I lead with, well, it depends.
Right.
Because, you know, and it really depends on how many SKUs you have overall as well, too. So, but, you know, if you think about capital efficiency and where you're spending your cash, I think you would want to lean into the areas that you're having the success. And, you know, you may want to cut the bottom SKU, or maybe it's only one or maybe it's two. I don't, you know, it depends on a lot. But if you're thinking about scaling a business sustainably, you would want to lean into the products that are obviously selling better because you're able to turn your inventory quicker, make your capital work for you quicker. You can also look into more kind of financing instruments, which if you have slow moving inventory and you're using sort of like these short-term financing solutions, that becomes very expensive. But if you have things that are moving quicker, then that's where those tools can become a little bit better for you to sort of, you know, magnify your cash. It'll make the return on your, you know, I would call it sort of like the equity dollars higher. But, you know, you can sort of bifurcate your portfolio of SKUs in a way where you can apply those methods to the quicker moving ones, which is a little bit safer. You know, I think if you're building towards products that are pulling naturally and things are going well, obviously everything is smoother. If you're trying to sort of push the boulder uphill and you're spending a lot on ads and, you know, all of those other things for products that aren't working well, then all of your capital efficiency metrics really go down quite a bit.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. All right, we're going to take a quick break and then we're going to come back and talk about other finance fun things. We'll be right back.
Forever Cheese, a leading importer of cheese and specialty food, has sourced exceptional products from Italy, Spain, Portugal, and Croatia for 25 years. Offering a wide selection of artisan cheese, charcuterie, nuts, crackers, preserves, and more, their products are sold in stores nationwide. Forever Cheese seeks out the best of the Mediterranean and focuses on sharing stories from their family of producers. Each product has a unique story, and their goal is to celebrate each one. From Drunken Goat to genuine Fulvi Pecorino Romano, Mostarda to Mitica Marcona Almonds, and Duya to Jamon Iberico, Forever Cheese is proud to offer products they love from people they believe in. Their passion, quality, and range are unmatched. Learn more at forevercheese.com and look for their products in a grocery store, restaurant, or specialty food shop near you.
I'm back with Anthony Domenici from Basecamp. Okay, so same founder, year later, they're getting a green light from Target. And now they need to raise money. So they had a really nice $3 million a year. You know, most of the SKUs are working. A couple of them aren't as well. Target is taking three of them. You know, they know they're going to need some money. Now they have to kind of step up their financial leadership game a little bit. What do they do then? Next step.
Well, I think I'm going to go back to it depends. So it depends on what they've already done. So if you've raised like a friends and family round, or if you have a certain amount of debt, if you've gotten a $3 million sales, I have to imagine there's some sort of capital happening here. So you would have to sort of take a look at your balance sheet and see what you've done already. And then next step would be to figure out the what. So if we say, you know, these are the velocities I know and I expect to continue. This is what my projections look like. You know, putting together a forecast and a cash flow forecast to understand where the shortfall is. So then if you understand what, then we would go to figure out how to solve for that. Mm-hmm. So, and then, you know, that could mean equity, or it could mean debt, or it could be mean both. I think it would just depend on kind of where you're at, what you've done, what your appetite is for, you know, risk, and also just the type of, like, it also depends on like what's your goal. So if I feel like there's this whole kind of unicorn like social equity thing about you know, like, I became a unicorn brand and I exited, and that's like the dream of everybody, that, you know, starting a brand, where like that kind of can get you in trouble as well. So it really is like, what are you trying to achieve as a person, and what are your personal goals? And then that can really inform the sources of capital that you're going to go out and get.
Well, I'd like to ask you about that a little bit, because so last week I had Janica Lane on, who's an M&A banker, and she's done, you know, her whole career has been basically doing M&A with CPG companies. And she told me that they have an expression, build your company like you're never going to sell it because you might not be able to. It was something like that. It was much more clever than that. but the idea is that idea of we're going to triple every year and we're going to get to 100 million and then we're going to sell for, you know, 700 million is just so few and far between, and you can't really build your company planning for that, because, you know, it's so unlikely to happen and it can really bite you. So the problem though then becomes, very few of us in the food CPG space are going to be able, on the flip side, to build companies that set off enough cash at the end of every year to, you know, sort of take care of us forever. Right. It's not that kind of a business. It just the ecosystem of the business is that these big strategic players own it. They own distribution. They own the shelves. They own the pricing. They own everything. Yes. And we're not even playing the same game. So what are the alternatives? I mean, instead of us founders setting ourselves up for, you know, trying to scale to exit, what should we or could we be setting ourselves up for that is a pleasant lifestyle and going to make us feel fulfilled?
Yeah, I think, I mean, you're not wrong with all of those points. But I think what really ends up striking with people is just the authenticity of, you know, why are you doing this in the first place? Because I think there is a whole like founder's mindset and, I don't know, mental block that you really have to get over to even do this in the first place, because you're probably going to work harder than you've ever worked in your life. And you're probably going to make, you know, half or less than that than you made last year or whatever. If you started your own business, maybe even less than that, maybe nothing the first year. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole sort of like grit and, you know, I don't know, survival mentality that you have to have to even do this. So I do believe that, you know, there's plenty of groups out there and companies that have started with the intention of exiting that have done well and done that. But, you know, a lot of times what really has people respond to a product is the authenticity of the founder, the story, and, you know, something that you've seen in your life that you're solving for that you really wanted and you couldn't find. And, you know, those types of things I think strike with people. And when you're trying to build something that means something to you, you know, those two things will probably happen at some point, which is you're going to build a company that can sustain you and your family. And, you know, you might blink one day and you sell it and it'll be, you know, an amazing achievement at that time. But I think also just getting to a place where you're able to work in a business that you create and love and, you know, grind away at is, I think, part of the dream as well. I think there's this whole, like you kind of have to love the grind. Even if you are doing well, it's still going to be a grind and it doesn't really get simpler or easier. You might have more cash at some point in time and you might take on investors and you might have debt and it's just going to get more and more complicated. So, you know, I don't know if there's really like one answer.
Love the grind most of the time is the thing.
Yeah.
You know, whenever I onboard anybody to my company, you know, I heard, you know, it's kind of like the 80-20 rule about anything. You know, I'm like, I don't expect you to love your job 100% of the time. I don't think there's any expectation of that. There's no relationship that's great 100% of the time. There's no place that's great 100% of the time. So I can't imagine this job will be. But if you start dipping below 80, then I need you to let me know. You know, and I think it's similar for founders. Like if you find yourself really unhappy running your company more than, you know, 20% of the time, there's a problem, you know, and I think that's a fair estimate, you know, one out of every 5 days, I feel like crap. Or, you know, one out of every 5 hours, I feel like crap. I think that like 80-20 feels about right, you know, because I think setting, you know, people think they love the grind, but then they get tired and then they get a no from a retailer or then an investor tells them that they haven't really built anything all that special. Or whatever it is, it's really painful, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's clearly the hard part is, you know, it's really easy for people to say something negative about something you've, you know, spent hours and hours and months and years building, you know, kind of flippantly, and it's like can be really crushing. But, you know, I think one of the things that I found that was helpful is having a good partner to run your business with, like a co-founder. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I think it helps you kind of get through those tough times. I don't, you know, disagree that there's every founder has, you know, rough patches in their business and, you know, hard lessons learned. And, you know, for me, I think one of the important things was being able to just sort of pivot and learn from those things, you know, and keep moving forward. Right. And I know it's easy to say because there's certain degrees of issues that you run into, and some of them might be more catastrophic than others. But yeah, I think you definitely have to love the product and the story. I'm cool with going with the 80-20, 80% of the time.
okay.
Because you do. I mean, it's never going to go perfectly all the time, and you have to be able to move past those tough times and continue to love what you're doing.
Yeah. Going back to sort of like that fictional founder, right? So mm-hmm. every month she should know her velocities in certain accounts, the ones that she can get them from. She should know how much cash she has. She should know,
yeah.
you know, the last month sort of what happened with the margins, what happened, was there any crazy trade spread from UNFI that she right. got hit? She should know what else? I mean, obviously top line sales.
I think one of the things that you touched on there is important to know. We sort of like skimmed over it quickly, but being able to get that information in a timely fashion. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's certain companies out there that may not need it, you know, immediately. But there's plenty of companies that I think need to have their financials and information, you know, readily available within, you know, call it 10 business days of the prior month.
Right.
You know, if your business is moving quickly, being able to rely on that information to make decisions is really important. And, you know, as you scale, the further you get, well, the larger you grow, the more people you add, the further you get disconnected from every detail of your business. So having mm-hmm. sort of that data at your fingertips, I think is really important. But, yeah. you know, I think, you know, the major categories are going to be kind of what we touched on, you know, sales, margins, contribution margins, your inventory, days on hand of inventory, your receivables, how much cash, what's your burn like? So especially in the current market that we're in, managing your cash burn month to month is really important. And what's your runway left? So if you're not profitable, how can you manage your burn? And I think with a CPG company, it's going to be a little bit chunkier. With like a service company, it's a little bit more predictable. You sort of have expenses that are not related to inventory.
Right.
Where if you have inventory and you have a massive buy-in or minimums, and then you might not have to buy inventory for a few months, so you should be generating cash, you know, the following months,
yep.
at least more than when you're buying inventory. So I think that's something that's really come up in the last, you know, 6 months, the sort of the changing dynamic of, you know, the capital market and sort of the, I think, the, you know, one of the initial questions that you asked me around, you know, get profitable, really around sort of like surviving and making my cash last. So I think that might be the most important right now is if you're not profitable, understanding your burn and what the runway is and how to manage yeah. that as best you can.
So speaking of burn, I remember when I was opening the brick and mortar cooking school and I was in a master's program at the time and I was taking a class and the, you know, professor basically said like the hard, fast rule in like brick and mortar hospitality is that your rent should not be more than 10% of your sales. So
okay.
if your rent is $22,000 a month, you should make at least $220,000 in sales a month, basically. And it was interesting because I think everyone kind of hears and is like, wow, 10%, like what could possibly make up for, you know, the rest, you know, but inevitably so much makes up for the rest. And there are so many things. And if you want to take home anything at the end of the month, It is a very good physical law to sort of abide by.
Right.
Are there any that are sort of similar in CPG? Like your G&A should not be more than X percent of your total revenue, or your, you know, anything on like the sort of when people are putting together what they think their burn is going to be, or when they look at their burn and they're like, wow, gosh, how am I spending that much? You know, that there are just some simple sort of like, this shouldn't be more than 10%. This shouldn't be more than 20%. Like that you can just kind of generally abide by.
Yeah. I mean, I think, again, it depends on like the stage that you're in and where you're headed. I think early on your marketing spend is going to be huge. It's going to be like 20 or 30% of your, you know, P&L of your revenue, which you want to, if you think about like kind of the numbers you touched on at the beginning of like your product margin 60, gross margins 40 to 50%. If you want to make 10%, you know, net income or, you know, EBITDA, then you basically have that 30 to 40% to play with. So it could sort of depends on what else you have going on. If you have, you know, an office, or if you're doing the manufacturing yourself and you have equipment, you have all these, you know, utilities are high. It kind of just depends on what stage and what your operating model is. You know, where if you're doing, you know, co-man, which most people are probably, you might have less of that sort of like fixed cost infrastructure, and you have a lot of variable costs. So, you know, I think, you know, G&A, you know, in a loose term, when you're talking about, you know, excluding marketing,
I think of G&A as team and rent.
Yeah.
But
I guess it also depends on like your labor, like what kind of labor you're leveraging. But, you know, I guess if I would say like sort of like a more established business, you know, you want your marketing probably to be closer to 10 or less if you can. It just depends on what stage you're in. And then, you know, G&A probably another 10 to 15. And then you're just going to have a bunch of miscellaneous things that add up, sort of like the death of a thousand cuts that you don't even think about. But, you know, I honestly, most of the time in my career, I try not to operate with those rules, because every company has been so different. That's one of the benefits that I've found in growing Basecamp, is I've seen so many different business models and stages of business, and, you know, different revenue makeup and industries within packaged goods or inventory-based businesses. It's hard to apply one general rule, but I think if you just think about like you have gross profit or contribution margins, and there's a goal of profitability you're trying to get to and to pay yourself, you sort of have this other chunk that you need to look at your business and understand what makes that up, and then probably set parameters within that, call it 30 to 40% that you have left, and figure out what makes sense for you right now. It could be that you need to spend a majority of that on marketing right now.
Right.
You know, if you have a new product launch or whatever is going on, but you need to know what the other levers are to pull. And I think that's really what it comes down to, is understanding the drivers and the levers in your business. So a lot of times when you go through like a budgeting or a modeling or an operating plan, I think that's the most valuable part about that, is it forces you to stop, look at your business, understand the drivers, make strategic, you know, educated guesses about what's going to happen. But then when reality happens, you understand what are the levers that you can pull. So
right.
I think that's really what it comes down to, is, you know, what's fixed, what's variable, what can you do when reality happens?
Yeah, no. And I think this is actually really a helpful way to look at it, because, you know, you hear fixed and you hear variable, and, you know, if you're like me, you're like, you know, yeah. But I think part of the question is always, you know, I've had guests on, and, you know, I mean, I'll say it over and over, you know, look at each sales channel, like look at each retailer that you're in and make sure you're actually making money there. It's really hard conceptually to see that you are having a lot of sales in a retailer, or that you're up 50% in a retailer, or that your velocity is quite strong in a retailer, but that you're not making money in that retailer. It's really disconcerting to see that, you know, it's strange.
It's tough.
And you know, I find myself being like, wait, why? Like what? You know, like because by the time you add back the, you know, they bill you back for expired, or, you know, it's the freight to get to them is so much more than if you did it another way, that the margin's already kind of tweaked. Like, and that's where I think getting that granularity, similar with the SKUs, right? Like going back to what you said before the break, you know, we have two SKUs that are sort of tied for last place. And there are people who are obsessed with both of them. They do well in different retailers. One of them happens to be our most expensive, you know, SKU to make, which is obviously irritating to me. but, you know, every time I'm sort of like, maybe we should just like send her to pasture, you know, then we worry about, you know, are we going to get that spot back in the retailers that do sell it? And are we going to have less of a brand presence if we go from 4 to 3 on some retail shelves? And, you know, so obviously a swap is better, but swaps are hard and not every retailer can do them. And, you know, these, you know, I guess practically, you know, if we had someone saying like, listen, this is how much money this SKU is making you, but this is how much money you're losing. So actually this SKU is negative $200,000 a year or whatever it is. I think it would make the decision much easier, but I don't know how many of us are actually doing that.
Well, I think the first hurdle I run into when we start having those conversations is pulling the data together to even answer that question. And that kind of goes back to sort of having, you know, really good process and bookkeeping around all this data, because it's not an easy question to answer if you don't have it set up properly. And I've helped companies get to those questions. And I think half the time they're surprised at the answer. I think, you know, they might think they're, you know, direct consumer channel is the most profitable, and it could be up on the front end because of your price and your product margin. But by the time you add a 3PL and all the other, you know, nickel and diming, pick pack, it depends on if you're selling the combo packs and all these other things that can be like adding up, the blended margin on that could even be lower than your wholesale margin. And people don't even really realize it until you put the number right in front of their face. But it might take us, you know, 30 or 60 days to even get that together, because we have to dig through a ton of data. So it's, and those are the kinds of things I think that are difficult to do early on, but are really beneficial, because when things start to go well and you start scaling, and like your story here that we came up with, when things start to get complicated, it's really hard to go back and build that stuff.
Right.
Because you just have so much more data and history to dig through and figure out what happened, and you don't really have time to even look at it. So as you're building, slowly building those building blocks will help you make those decisions in real time when things start to go move quicker.
Yep.
And I see that over and over again.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, one of the questions was, you know, is always around, I think also, you know, a lot of us get models put in front of us by finance folks, and we look at two things, you know, or three, and the rest of it is just Excel and sort of, you know, disconcerting. But, you know, making the model actually work for you, making it something that you don't feel like you missed a boat, but you feel like you can actually impact and make change that you need to. I mean, we all know that, you know, the most, I guess, the big variable costs are the people, right? Mm-hmm. Like at the end of the day, a lot of us that have invested in building brands have humans that are doing jobs that I guess arguably aren't 100% imperative to making the product and getting the product on shelf. they are important in terms of building awareness and making sure that, you know, people are seeing it and that it's continuing to grow. But, you know, I think even going back further, if people knew that they should, if people knew how to look at each retailer, and if people knew how to look at the variable costs of each channel and each distributor and each product, you know, I think there'd be a lot less sort of hire and then fire and then hire again and then fire. You know, I feel like people,
yeah,
you know, if we were armed with that.
Well, I think one of the things that I see is building like models and projections in a way that are really hard to measure against. So it sort of has to go back to your matching your modeling to sort of the way the accounting works. So like there's occasionally I see a model that has like excruciating detail in like all the wrong places. Like, you know, there's places that are really the most impactful for your business. And that's going to be sort of this like net contribution is the first place where, you know, a lot of people understand their product cost because they're probably the one that's, you know, built it and sourced all the materials and they're very familiar with that. But when you start getting into, to the selling channels with all the other fulfillment costs, being able to, one, you know, model that out in a way that's easy to understand, but then also track those expenses in the same way. And then sort of building the rest of your business, like there's this phrase that came up this week or last week that were like pennies or prisoners. Like you don't necessarily have to model everything out to the penny and understand all of your operating expenses to the penny, but it's more about key drivers in your business and managing sort of like the buckets. And I think that's right. The way we try to model the rest of the operating expenses, your big buckets are going to be marketing, your sales, you know, sort of selling expenses, marketing, labor, and then all the other sort of administrative G&A expenses. Right. So, you know, we build out a labor model. We build out, you know, a marketing plan. We build sales revenue by channel. And then in that revenue channel, there's additional expenses that match up with those channels. So wholesale may have commissions. You know, you might be shipping, you know, containers or whatever, who's covering those expenses. And then, you know, direct to consumer, layering all those expenses, your advertising costs, ads, like all those things kind of come into play. But you also have to be able to book those and track it. And I think having a budget, so if you're going through this exercise of, I'm really thinking about my business, I really understand it, I understand the drivers, and then you need to measure against it. Because I think if you think you know it and then reality starts coming through and it's different, you need to be able to measure those results and make new decisions based on that information. And I think it's really like an iterative process, you know, almost like a, when you're really early in your business, creating a 1-year operating plan, I think is a good exercise, but in reality, you probably have to look at it every quarter and kind of, does it seem to make sense anymore? A year is like an eternity in a, you know, a small startup scaling business. So you kind of have to create this engine of sort of measure, iterate, you know, pivot, and then go. And you have to just sort of keep doing that over and over again as you grow.
Yeah. And I mean, right now, you know, it's mid-June as we're recording this. And, you know, at least in my category, a bunch of the retailers that we thought were resetting by now have not. Some of them, you know, we have some outlying yeses that have not reset. And we have some outlying meetings that we were supposed to have in Q1 that we have not had. And so, you know, I know I'm not alone. I mean, I know that there's a lot, especially in fresh and in some cases in frozen. And I also know that, you know, retailers that maybe would touch the set, you know, a major kind of reset once a year and maybe, you know, a mid-year sort of little gentle touch, they're not even doing that anymore because of the labor that it costs the retailers to do that. So it's June. It's time for all of us to say, am I really going to hit X million in sales this year? If so, where, like, how confident I am, you know, that these things are going to come through? Did everything just get shifted, you know, another 6 months out? And if not, I need to start planning for what this year looks like if it's, you know, an $8 million a year, not a $12 million a year. And so what are some of those things that you're advising your companies to look at right now?
Well, I think, you know, any business should be looking at their forecast or budget at least once, you know, even if you're mature. Smaller should be probably, you know, quarterly is what I usually recommend. But I think at the end of the day, you're trying, well, I guess if your goal is to be profitable, what is your targeted, you know, EBITDA margin? And then you basically have to solve back for it, just kind of like we sort of talked about it. Like, you know, if I have 50% margin or 40% margin, I'm trying to make 10. If my revenue is going to be lower, then my costs have to be lower. So what are my variable components? And what are, so if you're opening, let's just say what you talked about, like there's some resets, you were expecting to get new doors. Those doors aren't happening. Therefore, you're not going to have the sort of added, you know, corresponding expenses, you know, maybe free fills or chargebacks or whatever comes along with that. So those are sort of variable and match the revenue. But what are the fixed components that you might have to be looking at? And I think that kind of goes back to the cash burn, you know, and capital discussion, the common thread here of, you know, what are the levers and drivers in your business? So what are the fixed costs? So, you know, if you have an office or rent or, you know, if you're paying for some data or some sort of services that you may not, you know, be able to afford in the next 6 months. You know, nobody wants to cut headcount. That's probably one of the most painful parts of being a business owner is having to make those kinds of decisions. But I mean, that's the reality that people have faced in the last, you know, 9 months to a year, which is, you know, capital is drying up. You want to keep operating your business. You have to make those decisions. And it's never easy, but I think that's really what we're looking at now is, I think when there's also this thing when like you're growing and you're trying to grow quickly, I think in a small business, the hardest place to hire people is someone to do the things that you can only do early on, which is, I think, growing, innovation, selling, being the face of your company. The place where you can should be looking at spending is basically giving yourself more time to add more value to your business. So it's more of the back office sort of G&A things that are, you know, administrative tasks that you can pay somebody to do on a fractional basis or 1099. That's a lot more variable. You can turn off pretty quickly. And just gives you more time in the day to lead and grow and push your business in the right direction. And I think those are the areas where when things are like kind of on the upswing, you tend to get a little fat. You know, just like you see in all these large companies, all these tech companies, you know, they all get fat when times are good and then they cut pretty deep. So you kind of have to do the same exercise in your own business.
Not fun, but
no.
We want to end on a good note. So tell me that you've seen these types of, you know, tough times before and that it's really fun on the other side.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think the last, call it 10 years have been mostly positive, I think.
Yeah, a little.
There's always some like pockets in there that are, but everything is cyclical, right? I think there's a common, I don't know, when I just think about the general economy, there's sort of like this common misconception that like the economy turns on a dime and we're always going to be on this, we're never going to be right in the middle. Like never, nothing's ever right in the sweet spot for very long. You're always above it or below it. And you just sort of have to keep riding that wave. So,
That's like life.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Like you're never going to be like right in the perfect spot for longer than a couple seconds. So, you know, I think part of the thing is, you know, you definitely want to celebrate your wins, but getting too high and too low is something that I've kind of learned to deal with on my, just with myself, my own business. Because, you know, this, you sort of get used to that normal and you just keep going and things keep evolving. So I don't know if there's, obviously this will pass and things will get better eventually. And I think it's, there's certain leading indicators that are out there that say, you know, things may start to open up soon, but who knows, you know? So right. I think you just got to keep doing what feels right to you, being authentic to yourself and your brand and what you think is right. And, you know, if you have to make some tough decisions to extend the life till you're able to find the next, mm-hmm. you know, investment or financing or whatever it is, you know,
that's what you got to do.
That is what you got to do. And I think, you know, we as our own business, are, you know, trying to work with our companies to do the same. When we see cash balances getting low, we reach out to them and say, hey, are you watching this? Like, we better, let's mm-hmm. talk about it. What do we need to do here? And, you know, I think, anyway, I think we're here to support any of these businesses or people that are listening. You know, if you're trying to get, you know, data out of your company, you need some infrastructure to make these tough decisions. Definitely here to support that. You know, I think it will pass.
Amazing.
You know, hopefully we can all, you know, make it through to the, to the other side.
Yes. Well, thanks to people like you and hopefully, you know, all the resources that are available now, hopefully in terms of just, you know, thinking this stuff through for founders and operators, you know, this too shall pass. So Anthony, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show. Thanks for breaking it down. And, I learned a lot, so it was great meeting you and having you on. Thank you.
No, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Awesome. Liam, thank you for engineering as always. And all of you, I did get that negative review that I posted on LinkedIn. Some guy, he had a couple of points. I can be, you know, I can be humble there. But for all of you who responded to him by writing really nice reviews, I just want to say thank you. And obviously the review is a nice ego thing, but mostly it's just so that other founders and operators can hear all of these amazing people that I'm having on. It doesn't really do all that much for me personally. So thank you on behalf of the other people that get to listen to this, because it comes up in their podcast feed. And I will be back next week with another episode of In the Sauce.
In the Sauce is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.